Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
On the Podium Season 2 is available now.
Like many people in this world, I had never seen an Olympic medal before.
Bringing you more remarkable stories of Olympic and Paralympic athletes and their incredible journeys to the podium.
This is my dream and it came true that day.
Find out more at the end of this podcast.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Audrey Brown. British politics is in turmoil at the very top once again. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's leadership and character is at the centre of discussions once again. It's all about what he and his defenders have said and done about a top official who'd been accused of sexual assault. The Prime Minister's office first said he didn't know about it. Then, in increments, they finally acknowledged that Mr. Johnson had been told about it, but forgot. Last night, the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Health resigned, saying they couldn't continue working with the Prime Minister. Several more junior members followed suit. Today, the Prime Minister faced members of Parliament.
I abhor bullying and abuse of power anywhere in Parliament, in this party or in any other party.
But the leader of the opposition Labour Party, Keir Starmer, took a swipe at the whole of the government for supporting the Prime Minister for so long.
As for those who are left, only in office because no one else is prepared to debase themselves any longer, the charge of the lightweight brigade. Have some self-respect. Mr. Speaker, for a week, he's had them defending his decision to promote a sexual predator. Every day, the lines he's forced them to take have been untrue. First, that he was unaware of any allegation. Untrue. Then, he was unaware of any specific allegation. Untrue. Then, he was unaware of any serious specific allegation. And now, he wants them to go out and say that he simply forgot that his whip was a sexual predator. Anyone with anything about them would be long gone from his front bench.
Mr. Johnson, though, insisted he would continue in the job.
When things are tough, of course people turn their fire on the leader of the country, but it is my job to get on and deliver our manifesto, which we are, and to deliver on the mandate on which I was elected, and to get this country through tough times, just as we got it through COVID. And that is what I'm going to do.
Now, after questions to the Prime Minister had finished, Sajid Javid, who resigned as the Health Minister on Tuesday evening, explained to the House of Commons why he felt he had to resign from Mr. Johnson's cabinet.
This week again, we have reason to question the truth and integrity of what we've all been told. And at some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough. Yeah. I believe that point is now. I welcome the Prime Minister's public acknowledgement last night that matters could have been handled better in who he appointed and what was said about what he knew when. And I appreciated his kind and humble words and his humble spirit when I went to see him yesterday, and also the kind letter that he has sent to me. But I do fear that the reset button can only work so many times. There's only so many times you can turn that machine on and off before you realise that something is fundamentally wrong.
At the end of that statement by Mr. Sajid Javid, the Speaker of the House, Lindsay Hoyle, had this to say.
Yeah. Can I say to the House, there will be no more personal statements today.
Bye, Boris. Bye.
Now, one minister who has been defending the Prime Minister, Conor Burns, had this exchange with the BBC's Joe Coburn.
The Prime Minister is incredibly focused on delivering on the mandate that he was given by the British people 2.5 years ago in 2019, a very personal mandate. And I remember how broken our politics appeared to be before Boris became Prime Minister. We'd lost our majority under Mrs. May. Parliament was overturning the will of the British people in the referendum. And Boris went to the British public and got a significant mandate. And he is determined to fulfil that.
Right, but just
my
to...
My message to colleagues is calm down. Calm down.
Really? Are they overreacting?
Be very careful.
In your view, even though...
Be very careful where we go here.
Why?
Be very careful about bringing down a Prime Minister who won a very personal mandate from the British people in 2019. We saw what happened when Mrs Thatcher was removed from power in 1990 and the toxicity that was injected into the Tory party's bloodstream. And it took a decade or more for that to work through. Be very careful about bringing down a democratically elected Prime Minister.
Now, Andrew Bridgen has been a Conservative Member of Parliament since 2010, and he's a long-standing critic of Mr. Johnson. I caught up with him just as Boris Johnson finished answering questions in the House of Commons earlier. So what did he make of Mr. Johnson's performance today?
I think you have to admire the Prime Minister's resilience at the dispatch box when he's inundated by resignations from his government, but it doesn't change the fundamental fact that he's lost the confidence of the Conservative Party, and he's lost, I believe, the confidence of the electorate.
Has he lost the confidence of the Conservative Party, though? Because he's still there, and there don't seem to be any plans for him to be unseated as leader of the party and the country.
Well, he suffered the humiliation of a confidence vote about 5 weeks ago, which he survived, but there were 148 Conservative MPs who voted no confidence at that time. Since then, the government has suffered two crushing by-election defeats at either end of the country, and support for the Prime Minister has diminished after that. And we've had the scandal, the debacle over the Deputy Chief Whip's appointment and then dismissal for inappropriate conduct last weekend. And unfortunately, the truth has had to be dragged from the Prime Minister rather belatedly by a letter from a senior civil servant who pointed out that the Prime Minister was well aware of the conduct of Chris Pincher, the MP for Tamworth, who's now lost the whip and is facing an investigation for his activities.
And yet here we are, and including the fact that two senior members of Boris Johnson's government have resigned, several junior ministers, and he still seems to be, as you said, resilient and hanging in there.
He is. I think there'll be continual trickle of ministerial and government resignations today. The 1922 committee, the committee of all backbench Conservative MPs, is convening this afternoon. I honestly believe that they will have got enough letters of no confidence that they'll go and tell the Prime Minister that the game's up and he needs to resign today. Otherwise, we'll reconstitute the committee with elections over the next week and we'll change the rules and we'll have a second vote of confidence before summer recess, which the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, will not survive.
How certain are you of that? Because he has shown a remarkable resistance to any attempts to get him out.
He is very resilient, I'll give the Prime Minister that. I've spoken to a lot of colleagues who were tremendously loyal to the Prime Minister until the last weekend. I can assure your listeners that I'm no longer a rebel. For the last 7 months I've been calling for the Prime Minister to go. I'm no longer a rebel because well over half of the parliamentary party now support the position that the Prime Minister's continuation in office is untenable. And for the good of the country, for the good of our parliament and democracy, and indeed for the good of the Conservative Party, he needs to stand down now and allow us to move forward without him.
Could this be done without the Conservative Party?
The only way it could be done without the Conservative Party is if we were to have a general election. We don't need a general election. We have a comfortable majority in the House of Commons. The fact that the Prime Minister has lost the confidence of the House and the party doesn't mean that another leader wouldn't be able to have the confidence of a majority of the House.
If that's the only way of getting him out, would you do it?
It isn't the only way, and we will change the rules of the 1922 committee in the next week. If the Prime Minister doesn't heed the warning I believe he's going to get this evening from Sir Graham Brady, the chairman of the 1922 committee, that the game is up.
So you're expecting the Prime Minister to resign tomorrow, tonight?
Yeah, either tonight or tomorrow, yes.
What happens next then? Who would be chosen or who's in line to be Prime Minister then?
I think in the circumstances, Dominic Raab, the Deputy Prime Minister, would be the interim Prime Minister while we have a ballot to select a new leader of the Conservative Party who will become the new Prime Minister.
I take it you'd be very disappointed if this doesn't happen tomorrow or if he doesn't resign tonight.
I think it'd be very bad for our country. It'll be bad for our democracy if the clear will of the parliamentary party does not prevail over this. I understand the Prime Minister's reluctance and his resilience in standing up and clinging on to power, but it isn't about power. This is about democracy. It's about what's good for our country. And I do hope that the Prime Minister will, perhaps for the first time, put the country first and his own ambitions second.
And that's Andrew Bridgen, Conservative MP and long-standing critic of Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Rob Watson is our political correspondent, and he's on the line to help us navigate the story. Rob, Mr. Bridgen there sounded very confident that Boris Johnson will be gone by tomorrow. What is it looking like to you?
Well, I have to say, Audrey, that there is a palpable sense here at Westminster of power and authority ebbing away from Boris Johnson, this man who has effectively dominated British politics, if you think about it, since the Brexit referendum in 2016 up until this current moment. But ministers are deserting him, and in the process, launching extraordinary personal attacks on his leadership, on his truthfulness. So one really does have a sort of sense of this crisis coming to a head and of essentially his time in office just ebbing away.
Those words have been heard before, and you probably, Rob, might have uttered those words as well. What's different this time?
I couldn't quite hear you, but I think you said, you asked what's different this time. I think it's important to understand that this is an accumulation of events and a falling out of love between the Conservative Party and Boris Johnson that dates back to the end of last year, where he tried to defend an MP who had been found to be corrupt. Then was the scandal over Partygate. And then the latest thing, of course, was this idea that he had appointed someone to a senior job who had a bit of a history as a sexual predator and then misled everyone about what he'd known about this particular individual. So it's accumulation of those things, a sort of sense as well that Boris Johnson has become that most awful liability, as Conservatives would see it, and that is an unpopular populist, someone who is an absolute liability with the electorate rather than the amazing vote winner he'd proved to be at the referendum in 2016 and at the general election in 2019. But I guess that's politics. Your fortunes change, your star falls.
So is it a matter of hours, as Andrew Bridgen was saying, months, moments, days, what?
I don't know about hours, but I mean, I think one does get a sense that this crisis is terminal, that despite his best efforts, it's very hard to see Boris Johnson coming back from this. No leader has come back from such unpopularity in the country and in the party in the last 40 years. So how exactly Boris Johnson is going to do that is very hard to say. But whether it's today, whether it's tomorrow, whether it's weeks, that's harder. But you do get the sense that this is the end, and it's just a question of when.
Thank you very much. That's Rob Watson, our political correspondent. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, the Women's Euros football tournament kicks off in England.
It used to be just something that, like, they would, like, run away from the ball and be a bit girly, but now, like, more girls are just coming out and they're just like, oh, let's go have a game of football around the corner or something. Like, everyone loves football. It's just for everyone.
In other headlines, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has defended his record as calls grow from within his own party for him to resign. The South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has been attending a mass funeral for 21 teenagers who died at a party in East London. The social media site Twitter has taken the Indian government to court after it was ordered to remove content from its platform. And a fresh batch of COVID cases has prompted the Chinese authorities to impose restrictions on the city of Xi'an. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC in London, with me, Audrey Brown. Japan's Prime Minister Fumio Kishida wants to restart more of nuclear power plants more quickly as the country struggles to deal with the hottest early summer on record. June temperatures broke through 40 degrees last week, and Japan's power stations are struggling to keep up. But 11 years after the Fukushima nuclear disaster, the push to restart Japan's nuclear plants remains deeply unpopular. The site is being prepared to release over 1 million tons of treated cooling water into the Pacific Ocean. Our Tokyo correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes was at the plant to meet with fishing communities who are deeply opposed to the release of water.
Well, it's just after 7 o'clock in the morning in the little fishing port of Hisanohama on the coast of Fukushima. And the fishing fleet here is just coming back into port to offload its night's catch.
A few metres away, the morning fish auction is getting underway. The most prized fish are large flounders, followed by sea bass, mackerel, sardines and monkfish. For years after the Fukushima nuclear disaster, no one wanted fish from here. The fear of radiation was very strong. Sitting on his boat, Haruo Ono invites me to join him for a breakfast snack of raw white bait with soy sauce and wasabi.
This is raw fish caught this morning. According to Ono-san here, who caught it, he says there is nothing for me to be worried about. Nothing to worry about. It's safe.
After the disaster, prices here collapsed. But now fish from Fukushima is popular again. People know we check every fish for radiation, so they feel safe. But now the government wants to release this contaminated water into the sea. We do not trust them, and we do not feel safe.
Half an hour up the coast stands what is left of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. It's now a giant construction site and a huge engineering challenge. For the last 11 years, seawater used to cool the damaged nuclear reactors has been collecting in more and more giant steel storage tanks.
So we just climbed up to the top of the tallest building on the site here at Fukushima Daiichi. From here you can see the more than 1,000 huge water tanks that have been built here over the last decade to store the cooling water, the contaminated water from the plant. And it gives you a real sense of the scale of the problem. Because in these tanks, there is now nearly 1.3 million tons of contaminated water.
I've been brought into the plant to be shown why there is nothing for the world to fear from the water release. To do that, I have to get in full protective gear and enter the world's biggest facility for removing radioactive particles from water.
I'm inside now a huge, I mean a really enormous building. It's like the size of an aircraft hangar in here. Through here, the water is pumped through all sorts of different filters to remove 62 different types of radionuclide. Then it's going to be diluted and then eventually pumped into the ocean. At least that's the theory.
There is one radioactive isotope that even this multi-billion dollar system cannot remove. It's called tritium. Professor Noboru Takamura is a radiation expert at Nagasaki University.
Environmental effect due to the release of the tritium is very, very limited.
So the scientists say it's safe, but there is still a huge problem. Trust. Many people just don't trust the plant operator, Tokyo Electric Power Corporation. So I ask the deputy superintendent at the plant, Takehiro Kimoto, why people should now trust the corporation to manage the water release.
We don't ask the public just to take our word for it. We will show how we test and publish the result for all to see.
The water released from Fukushima will be no more radioactive than water released from nuclear plants all over the world. But the fishermen here have had their livelihoods ruined once before, and they have no desire for it to happen again.
And that's Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Fukushima. South Africans today bury the 21 teenagers who died in still-to-be-explained circumstances in a drinking hall late last month. The youngest was just 13, in a crowded venue celebrating the start of the winter holidays. They were found dead early on the morning of Saturday, the 25th of June. First thoughts were that they died in a stampede. Then poisoned alcohol was thought to be the reason, or perhaps a substance that they'd inhaled in the venue. Questions about how they died have yet to be answered. In the meantime, President Cyril Ramaphosa addressed the community who'd come to bury their children.
Our hearts are broken. We have lost our children here. There are parents who will not get to hug or to kiss their son or daughter again. There are grandparents who will not be blessed to see their grandson or granddaughter growing up and having their own families.
Nomsa Maseko is our correspondent in South Africa.
The mood in this community is one of grief. I mean, people were wailing uncontrollably as the coffin bearing the pictures, the faces of these young people who die. The youngest is 13, the oldest is 19, but there were empty coffins that were brought here. You know, it was said to be as a symbol of the unforgettable and disheartening and traumatic incident that occurred in this community. It's a community that unfortunately has a reputation of teenage and binge drinking. It's a community like many other communities in South Africa where teenagers are allowed to be drinking in drinking halls and alcohol is sold to them even though they are below the age of 18, which is the legal drinking age in this country.
And Nomsa, there are still questions outstanding about exactly how they died.
Indeed, questions are still there. The forensic pathologists have said that the teenagers may have died because of something they inhaled or ingested. In fact, one of the doctors who examined the corpses was given an opportunity to speak to the mourners, and he said that a stampede was ruled out as the cause of death because none of the dead teenagers had physical injuries on them. However, the community has still not been told how these teenagers were killed, which has frustrated and angered relatives.
And why are there delays in finding out? I mean, we're moving on for 2 weeks now.
Well, the police are saying that they are waiting for the health department to conclude the toxicology report. Samples were taken to Cape Town from where we are about 4 days after the deaths occurred. So the health department is the one that seems to be delaying.
There was grief and there was devastation across South Africa when people learnt about this. I mean, 21 young people dying in this way. But there was also a lot of finger-pointing, Nomsa. Can you tell us what the aftershocks of this were?
There was definitely, you know, the blame game. The parents blaming the tavern owners for allowing their children to even buy alcohol and even hang out at the tavern. Society was blaming parents, saying, how do you sleep at night when you don't even know where your child is? The police were also blaming parents. In fact, the police minister, Begita lambasted the parents and saying, how dare you allow your children to be gallivanting at night while you sleep peacefully? And the parents of these kids took exception to that, saying that they should not be the ones to blame because some of these teenagers did not directly, you know, say to the parents that they were going to drink at the tavern.
And that's Nomsa Maseko, our correspondent in South Africa. Welcome back. This is NewsHour on the BBC World Service. Now, it's 11 years since what became known as the Arab Spring spread across countries in the North African region and the Middle East. At the same time, people were protesting rising cost of living and a lack of democracy. Over the last decade or so, we've watched how Tunisia, where it all started, Libya, Sudan, Egypt and Lebanon, among other countries, navigate these momentous changes. Michael Robbins is the director of Arab Barometer. He told me why a recent survey of 23,000 people across the region was important.
So it's very important to document Arab public opinion. In a lot of these countries, we don't have regular surveys. There's not much known. And so we want to understand what ordinary people think and believe about their political situation. It is critical to understand public opinion in places that this is not something that's well understood through elections or through other factors like that, that we don't have the data.
So what did you find?
So we found a number of important things. One is that it seems that democracy is losing its shine in MENA, in the Middle East and North Africa. We see that people are saying that democracy is associated with poor economic outcomes, it's unstable, and it also has a sense that it's indecisive. But we do find that people still want democracy. So in a sense, they're realizing it's not a perfect system, but it is a system that is still better than the rest.
And by democracy, what do you mean? Regular voting, regular leaders changing, or just the kind of leadership that they have?
So democracy is a complex concept in the region. We find that people don't just think of it in terms of voting, but they also think about it in terms of economic and social outcomes, that they do want equality. They do want economics, people to be able to have better economic outcomes. So it's not just voting for people in the region. If you ask them, it is about other outcomes too, almost a kind of social democratic Swedish Norwegian model of.
So tell us some of the specific findings you came across in particular countries. I'm quite interested in, for instance, Libya and Tunisia, which are the two, and perhaps Egypt, and I don't know if you looked at Sudan as well. But, you know, just that because those countries were sort of the high points, as it were, of the Arab Spring.
And one of the things that we've seen in terms of attitudes towards democracy in Tunisia is attitudes have been changing increasingly. There's been increasing skepticism of democracy in Tunisia about can it solve economic and other challenges. This really is the poster child, if you will, of the democracy coming out of their uprisings. But at the same time, we are actually seeing more commitment to democracy amongst Tunisians, that people are more willing to say this is the only viable system. So at the same time, concern is increasing, but also a desire for democracy seems to also be increasing in Tunisia. And other countries are seeing somewhat of a similar trend. We are in a place like Libya, we are seeing that there's still a commitment to democracy, but there's not necessarily – there are great concerns. But we have seen an increase in – there was some hope around the GNU, the Government of National Unity. There was a hope that things would improve as a result. And we are seeing an increased level of trust. Again, as another thing we've seen in Tunisia, which is a bit different, I think is a real positive sign, is that there's an increase in – sense that women should play equal roles in politics to men. We've seen a huge shift, perhaps as a result of the new female prime minister, and I think this goes to a key piece, which is that seeing women in these roles is something that is more likely to make people believe that women can be in these roles. And so we have seen this not only in Tunisia, but in Lebanon and a number of other countries around the region. We have seen a positive shift in attitudes about women.
And that's Michael Robbins, director of Arab Barometer. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Audrey Brown. It's 4 months since Russian forces carried out one of the worst atrocities of their invasion of Ukraine. 8 unarmed men were shot dead in a mass execution in the suburb of Bucha outside Kyiv in early March. They were among around 1,000 people who died during the month-long occupation in the Kyiv region. But one man managed to escape the infamous massacre on Yablunska Street. Our special correspondent, Fergal Keen, has been to meet him. And I must warn you, there are distressing details in this report.
This long street, Yablunska Street, with its mixture of old and modern homes, brick-built, some wooden, is named for the orchards in many of the gardens. Yablunska, the place of the apple trees. To this quiet, pastoral place, the Russians brought a reign of terror.
Growing alarm about alleged Russian war crimes.
The killings at 144 Yablunska Street happened beside a nondescript office building that had become a notorious Russian torture centre. 8 men were killed by the Russians here. In the little courtyard where they were executed, there are bunches of flowers, red and white carnations, left by loved ones. The men joined the territorial defence in the opening days of the war. They were fathers, sons, brothers and neighbours, protecting their homes and families. Anatoly Prohichko, a 37-year-old father of 2 daughters, asked his wife Ola to help him pack for checkpoint duty.
I just started getting warm clothes for him. At that time, I felt there was nothing I could say to stop him. He'd made his decision.
The first Russian assault on Bucha in late February failed,
but by March 3rd they'd returned, and they were hunting for men of the territorial defence. Anatoly and eight others were by now hiding here at 31 Jablonska Street.
On the 4th, at 10 a.m, he sent me a message saying, "We're still sitting tight." That was his last message.
Soon afterwards, the Russians found them. CCTV cameras recorded the men being led at gunpoint towards the base at 144 Yablonska Street. Heads bowed, without shoes, each holding the belt of the man in front.
When the Russians left Kiev, when they were forced out, they believed they'd left no trace behind of any eyewitness. But they were wrong. One man did survive, and he fled to Poland. He's now agreed to speak with us.
I travelled by train to Poland to meet Ivan Skiba. He recalled the final words he heard from his captors.
The conversation went like this. What should we do with them? The second Russian says, "Finish them off. But just take them away so that they won't be lying here."
The men were led around the corner to a quiet courtyard facing onto some gardens.
We realised that we were being led to execution, and we simply said goodbye to each other. That was it.
Anatoly Prohichko tried to run, but the shooting started and he was cut down. Ivan was hit. The bullet passed through his side, causing only a minor wound. He pretended to be dead.
It was cold outside. Breath was steaming up from my mouth, so I didn't breathe. I didn't move. And at the same time, I was expecting a shot.
Ivan lay among the dead until the soldiers eventually left. Then he dragged himself over a fence and escaped. Now he lives with nightmares. The same one every night in which he's lying among the dead, perpetually waiting for the shot that will end his life. The dead are close in memory, for Ivan Skiba and for their families. Every day, Ola Prohichko visits the grave of her husband Anatoly, carrying two cups of coffee, one for him, one for her.
We've reached the graveyard now, and I've moved back to allow Ola the space she needs. She's placing flowers, white carnations, on Anatoly's grave. And now she has placed her hand on the earth. And she's going to keep coming here, she says, every day. She'll bring flowers, she'll sit and drink a coffee, and she'll be with the man she's lost. This is all that's left to her.
My younger daughter keeps saying, "Papa is near. Papa can see everything. Papa can hear everything." The older one, she gets distracted, like a child plays. But then she remembers and starts crying.
Do you talk to him still, yourself?
Yes, of course. All the time. When no one can hear me, I call him by his name.
That report by the BBC's Fergal Keane. Meanwhile, the fighting continues. In recent days, Russia captured the eastern city of Lysychansk, triggering the fall of the entire Luhansk province. This was hailed as a victory by President Vladimir Putin. But some military experts say it's a symbolic rather than a strategic win. Oleksiy Melnyk is one of them. He's a former Ukrainian Air Force officer, now with the Razumkov Center think tank in Kyiv.
The retreat from Luhansk cities of Severodonetsk and Lysychansk is not a strategic defeat for Ukraine. Also, it's not a strategic victory for the Russians, despite they claim this changing of positions as a kind of strategic point of the whole war.
What would it take for Ukraine to hold on to the eastern Donbas, do you think?
I am afraid that for some time Ukraine will be forced to apply the same tactics of buying time and resources for losing some of its parts of territory, which is very painful, both in the sense of morale and suffering of people, destruction of infrastructure. Unfortunately, Ukraine doesn't have enough resources to stop the Russian forces or conduct large counteroffensive operation.
There was the prospect of Western air power support and more weapons to Ukraine. Will it help? Is it the right kind of support that Ukraine needs in order to defend?
Ukrainian armed forces almost ran out already of the previous stocks of heavy weaponry, ammunition. So now Ukraine depends on supplies from the Western partners, from Lend-Lease, from other partners like the United Kingdom. If we talk about some very critical resources that Ukraine is lacking, is the air power and air defense systems.
So does Russia have the capacity to take the entire Donetsk region, do you think, right now?
I'm afraid that Russia still has this capacity, especially if they focus all their resources on taking over the rest of Donetsk region. Having said that, I would probably say that it's not for sure, because more and more it seems like Russia losing its offensive potential. And even the latest statements by President Putin that the troops that were involved in taking over Lysychansk need some rest and some reinforcement.
And that's Oleksiy Melnyk, who's a military expert from the Kyiv-based Razumkov Center think tank. Now, after being postponed for a year because of COVID, the Women's European Football Tournament is about to get underway. It showcases the best women players on the continent. And the host nation, England, will kick things off against Austria at Manchester United's Old Trafford Stadium tonight. The first match is sold out, but it's not the case all over the place. But it's hoped that this competition will further boost interest in the women's game, as the BBC's football news correspondent Alex Capstick reports.
England's players signing shirts and taking photos for an enthusiastic audience at one of their pre-tournament training sessions. Their big moment in the spotlight has arrived. They're one of the favourites for the Euros, but hosting the event is about much more than lifting trophies. Baroness Sue Campbell is the English FA's Director of Women's Football.
I think it's a really significant moment, and I think we've made great progress, but the expression I'm using is this will turbocharge everything for us, right from grassroots through to the professional game. I think it's a huge moment for the women's game. It's a fantastic showcase.
The women's game is growing all the time in England, and not just at elite level. As in many other parts of the world, there are plenty of opportunities for young girls to get involved. It's a training session at Astley and Tilsley FC, close to the town of Lee in Lancashire, which is hosting four games at the tournament.
It used to be just something that, like, they would, like, run away from the ball and be a bit girly, but now, like, more girls are just coming out and they're just like, oh, let's go have a game of football around the corner or something, like... Everyone loves football, it's just for everyone. Before I started playing football, I was like a very like shy person. And after, I think I've gained a lot of confidence from like, I don't know, like facing a lot of different teams and trying new things out.
These Euros are being touted as the biggest women's sports event in Europe, but it's not been without its challenges. The choice of venues is one that stands out. The opening match at Manchester United's Old Trafford is a sellout. Similarly, the final at Wembley. But there are some much smaller grounds which have raised concerns. Iceland will play two of their group games at Manchester City's Academy with a capacity of just 4,400. Further say their midfielder, Sara Björk Gunnarsdottir, is not happy.
It's just embarrassing, you know. Women football today, you know, they're filling out the stadiums. You can see Barcelona, Real Madrid, we have 95,000 watching the game. They are not prepared for that, you know, that we are, you know, we will sell more tickets than 4,000. It's disrespectful towards women football at this stage.
But while ticket sales have been relatively strong, there's still plenty of availability, especially for fixtures not involving the host nation. And it's why the organisers believe their choice of stadiums is about right. Baroness Sue Campbell again.
The games we're struggling with are where we've got two teams playing that aren't England. So although I know we did have a criticism of Manchester City's ground, I honestly think we've done quite well. And it, you know, there'd be nothing worse than a 60,000-seater stadium with 10,000 people in it. So we had to balance that all out. Did we get it right? Well, we'll reflect on it afterwards, but I think we got it pretty close, yeah.
On the pitch, superstars of the women's game will be out to impress big names like Spain's midfielder Alexia Putellas, the current World Player of the Year. Denmark's captain Pernille Harder, said to be the most expensive women's footballer on the planet. Could the Dutch striker Vivienne Miedema or England's exciting winger Lauren Hemp light up the tournament? There's no doubt the game has progressed on and off the pitch, and these Euros are being described as the most competitive ever.
Alex Kapsik reporting, and I have to scrutinise the teams to decide who I'll be rooting for. Either way, though, football will win. You're listening to the BBC World Service, and this is NewsHour. This is NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Let's return to our top story, the political crisis here in the UK, where the Prime Minister Boris Johnson is fighting to stay in office following a number of high-profile resignations from his government on Tuesday night. This morning, that has continued with a steady stream of resignations from more junior ministers in government. The new finance minister, Nadim Zehawi, appeared on BBC Radio to defend the Prime Minister and to urge the party to come together. But that appeal was hijacked by news of another resignation.
The way you deliver trust is by delivering outcomes for people. They want to see us focus on the economy and stewardship of the economy, rebuilding the economy, growing the economy, on national security abroad. We've got war raging on our continent and, of course, at home, 13,500 police officers recruited. And, of course, the backlog that Steve Barclay will deal with in the NHS.
Mr Zahawi, forgive me interrupting you.
Yes.
But as you were saying, the man who came on this programme on Monday morning to defend the Prime Minister has just resigned, Will Quince, the Education Minister, a minister in the department you left yesterday. It's over, Mr Zahawi, isn't it?
I'm sorry to see Will Quince go. He was my Children and Families Minister and a great minister. All I would say to colleagues is people don't vote for divided teams.
The Conservative MP Paul Holmes, who resigned from the government a few weeks ago, thinks that the Prime Minister's days are numbered.
I was a big supporter of the Prime Minister. I was a member of his government and voted for him in the leadership. But what I have faced and what many colleagues have faced is that question of integrity. When we have to go and look at our constituents in the eye and say what's been going on is acceptable, and ministers over the last few days have been doing that when we know that the things that they were told to say just wasn't true. I wasn't willing to do that anymore, and I don't believe a lot of other colleagues are also willing to do that. We represent our constituents, and the overwhelming message that I'm getting from mine is that it's time for a change.
And that's the Conservative MP Paul Holmes. Now, Camilla Turner is Chief Political Correspondent at the Daily Telegraph, and she joins us now. Ms. Turner, good afternoon to you. Welcome to NewsHour.
Good afternoon, and thanks for having me.
So your head must be spinning. How long do you think Boris Johnson has? Some people say it's a matter of hours. Others are saying it's not long, but can't quite say when. What do you say?
Yes, I think all those predictions sound not far off where I'm at, really. I think it could be by the end of the day, certainly by the end of the week. I think at this rate, we're seeing the ministerial resignations come in so thick and fast now. We just had five ministers resigning all in one go in a joint letter. I think it's basically when you get to the point where you can't even fill your ministerial positions and operate a government, that's when even this prime minister might realise that the game is just completely over for him.
But are those high-ranking ministers or are they junior ministers? And are you waiting perhaps for, you know, a couple of really key figures to go and then it will really be curtains?
So interestingly, the highest ranking ministers actually fired the starting gun last night when we had the resignation of the health secretary and the chancellor. Those are the absolute most senior ministers so far to go. The ones we've had overnight and so far today have been more junior. But there are reports starting to emerge that Michael Gove, another very senior minister, has visited the PM this morning and told him the game's up. So that would potentially be you know, we haven't yet publicly heard anything from Michael Gove, but that could potentially be another very senior minister also telling him it's game over.
But that's saying game over, which perhaps lots of people have been doing, and not quite the same as, you know, coming out into the open and saying, I'm resigning because the game is over.
That is very true. And I think we'll just see what happens over the next few hours. I think there really is now a sense that the resignations are coming in so quickly. It's a case of strength in numbers. Anyone who was wavering and sitting on the fence, not entirely sure, might see the amount of their colleagues resigning and refusing to serve in government and follow suit. I imagine even by the time I get off the line to you and back to my desk, there'll be another flurry of resignations. So I think what we've seen so far today is some of the lower ranking ministers, but I think in the next few hours that could seriously move up the scale as well.
And would it be the Prime Minister going, or would it be somebody, perhaps, you know, the power structures within the Conservative Party telling him that he has to go?
So there are a number of different mechanisms which could be kicked into action. It could be a case of, we've got the 1922 Committee of Backbenchers a meeting late this afternoon. They could decide on a rule change and say we could have another vote of no confidence. The current rules prohibit this from happening for another 12 months. But we could have them say the mood of the party is we need to have another vote. It could even be simpler as that and just have a delegation of senior MPs, perhaps from the 1922 Committee, perhaps the Chief Whip, just going to see the Prime Minister in person and tell him you need to resign, you no longer have the support of the party. So there could be a few different ways that it could happen. But of course, if the Prime Minister refuses to resign and clings on to power, we might be in a different situation.
And what would that be?
Well, essentially, he can't be forced to resign just by someone telling him to. He'd have to agree to it. However, if we were to do the no confidence vote, that is a tried and tested mechanism that would, if a vote was passed, that would trigger a leadership election. And then that would start the formal process of getting rid of him. But there would need to be a rule change in order to do that. So that would be another slightly longer winded method of getting rid of the Prime Minister. But at least in that instance, he wouldn't be able to fight against it. He would be bound by the rules, meaning that he'd have to start his exit strategy.
Now, you saw the Prime Minister's performance at Prime Minister's Questions time, as he was Prime Minister's Questions, as it's now called. He was facing MPs there. What did you make of it? Did he seem confident and, you know, prepared to go it alone?
Yes, it was a fascinating moment to be sitting in that chamber and watching what felt like quite a historic Prime Minister's Questions. You know, he was trying his best to sort of come back at the opposition's points and talk about the economy, talk about the cost of living. But really, he didn't look as energetic as he usually does. And he wasn't getting the roars of support and the cheers from his own backbenchers. So he did certainly look, I thought, a bit more defeated than he normally does in that situation.
So say he does go soon, who do you think will step into the role?
So there's a lot of speculation about who it might be. One of the potential candidates is Nadeem Zahawi, who only last night accepted a new position in the government as Chancellor, but he's seen as a potential front runner. There's also Rishi Sunak and Sajid Javid, who were the first to announce their resignation yesterday. Liz Truss is also talked about as a potential candidate, but really none of these people have got their campaigns fully underway because they've only just left government or perhaps are still in government. So no one's fully got their leadership bid up and running yet.
Thank you very much, Camilla Turner, Chief Political Correspondent at the Daily Telegraph, bringing to an end this hour of NewsHour. Thanks for listening.
I remember crossing the finishing line and my heart going, I think I've just won.
That is a significant moment when you first win a medal at Olympic Games.
On the Podium, the podcast where Olympic and Paralympic athletes share their remarkable personal journeys from their struggles.
When I went from 80% to 2% vision, my life was just a wreck.
It's not just an injury. It's having an injury 20 days before your dream.
How can I use this pain and this energy?
You just kind of got to like push through it and make the best of it.
To their victories.
We won 7 medal in Olympics and 19 medal in Paralympics. This will change the Indian sport.
On the Podium, from the BBC World Service.
We're ready to go. We're ready to have fun. We're ready to party.
Search for On the Podium wherever you found this podcast.